Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
Hello, this is The Interview with Carrie Gracie. My guest today is an explorer, an inventor and an engineer. He's determined to mine energy on the moon and to make space travel accessible. As a child, he wanted to be an astronaut, but he spent most of his adult life exploring the world's deepest caves. And now he plans to take into space the technology he's developed in the process. He says commercial mining on the moon can be up and running in 7 years, and he's looking for between $15 and $20 billion to make it happen. So would you invest in him or his project? Dr. Bill Stone, welcome to The Interview.
Thank you very much, Carrie. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, we've got a big global audience, Bill. Some of them are wealthy. You go ahead, you pitch. What's the idea?
The idea is fairly simple on the face of it. Basically, we establish a mine at the South Pole of the Moon to remove water from the bottom of a deep crater there that has collected over billions of years. We transport that back to Earth orbit, and we sell it to both governments and private companies, most directly the up-and-coming space tourism market.
And if this is such a good idea, why aren't others doing it? For example, the American Space Agency, NASA, or the energy giants, they've got plenty of cash.
Let's start with the first question. Government is not doing this for two reasons. Number one is institutional inertia. They have a way of doing things that has come about all the way back to the Apollo program. And for risk reduction purposes, in their view, they want to launch missions to the moon fully fueled in Earth orbit, land people there, and then bring them back. That means doing all of your business and fueling from Earth orbit. So therefore, the idea of going up and getting fuel on the moon to supply their own missions is just not part of their business model. Second is they are not a commercial entity, and they've made that publicly clear. So they're not going to be up there establishing a mine in order to fund their efforts and then sell, for example, the excess. That's just not in their business. Okay. Page two, why aren't the energy companies doing it? The reason is that they currently are not structured to understand that this is a new market. They understand their own market exceedingly well. They are making outrageous profits right now, and that's where they're putting their effort.
So whose idea is this, and how did it develop?
The idea is mine, in conjunction with some other people that I have met over the last decade. It came about largely due to work that I had done both on expeditions as well as work on the design of spacecraft at national labs. There was kind of an apocalyptic point there where I was shown the data from the Pentagon's Clementine mission back in 1995, and that data revealed the likely presence of very large quantities of hydrogen at the South Pole of the Moon. And when I saw that, many things clicked into place that would enable a private expedition to the moon. It was only later, after I had worked out some calculations, that I think, how could we actually carry out that expedition? And the answer came back, this has to be done as a positive return on investment company, because nobody is going to put the money up just for an expedition to go up there and carry their banner. It's the same reason, for example, that a NASA mission to the moon is not a profit-making operation. In fact, it's a very large negative return on investment.
You make it sound so positive, so profitable, but there's going to be one hell of a journey between the idea and making it happen, surely.
No one here underestimates the task. What I will say is that the people that we have on our team are extraordinarily qualified to organize this project and to run it. It's one of the reasons that nobody else has really thought about it or tried to think about doing it. What we have brought together with our team is a deep level of experience in organizing and fielding terrestrial expeditions to very remote, harsh, dangerous places operating in total darkness. That's one. And the other one is a significant level of experience in the space industry, that is launching space vehicles, space satellites, communications, command control, all of those things. So we have that in our team right now.
And just to pause for a moment, Bill, I mean, you talk about the harsh environments working in total darkness. I mean, on the face of it, it seems rather counterintuitive that people whose experiences in expeditionary caving could turn that around and apply it in space.
It just so happens to be an unusual circumstance that the place where the water, and we believe it is water, not just hydrogen, is located happens to be in total darkness. It's not a coincidence. The hydrogen that is there, and we still have to determine the exact quantification of that by landing a rover to do that, is there because the temperature at the bottom of those southern polar craters is minus 200 degrees C. That's what keeps the stuff there. No sunlight gets into those craters. That's why it's cold. Okay. So anybody working there is going to be working for sustained periods of time, a year or two, let's say, to get the mining operation up and running. So they're going to be working in total darkness at minus 200 degrees C. That takes a particular mindset of individual. It is not the astronaut or cosmonaut mindset. I know scores of these people, and I know that mindset. It comes out of the right stuff, as Tom Wolfe said in his book a long time ago. It's the people who have the hair edge trigger to do something, people who will work under timeline-controlled conditions. And so it just so happens, by total serendipity, that deep cave exploration on Earth, which is the last terrestrial frontier, is a similar environment. And that's where we would start our search for the crew that will pull this off.
Right. Well, we'll come back to the crew in a moment. But first, let's just go back to the science, because you're making some, they're not assumptions. You've obviously got data about the presence of hydrogen and other volatile gases beneath the ice, or what may be ice, on the moon. But what would prove you wrong, Bill? What would prove this mission unachievable?
Okay, so good question. Part of our plan is to straight off launch a proprietary rover into the floor of Shackleton Crater to characterize down to a depth of probably around 5 meters, possibly deeper, the quantitative content of that soil, which is referred to as regolith. It's basically dust. But our contention is it's stratified. It's very much like a sedimentary deposit buildup of ores and things like that. And that within that dust will be such things as frozen ice crystals, frozen ammonia crystals, possibly frozen methanol, possibly frozen carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, things like that.
So many questions, and it's all so fascinating about the science itself, but I'm not going to get into all the skeptical angles on how much of this fuel is there in the Shackleton Crater, whether it's mineable, how you then deploy it, and so on. I'm going to get back to the business angles, if you don't mind, Bill, and this question, a fairly blunt one: how much money have you raised so far?
The straight answer is we have not raised any external capital yet. So what we have is a nascent, the nucleus of a corporation that is unusual, unlike anyone that has ever been founded before. And that has value. How much value you want to put on it, that's hard to say. However, I can tell you this: nobody is going to pull this project off if they don't go the route that we're going. And we have already done the spade work to get to this point.
So how are they going to make the money?
Right. Hopefully everybody understands now that there is value in what's up there. The question is, how do you get it to market, and who is the market? This is part of the thing that we have been doing over the past year, is the identification of the market demand. Initially, the people who want this will be governments. Okay, it will be the European Space Agency, it will be the Russian Space Agency, NASA, the Chinese Space Agency. Why? Well, because once you see that it is possible to refuel in Earth orbit, you will change the architecture of your systems. Everybody's going to say, no, they're not going to change the architecture. I say, yes, you will. Why? The example is very simple. You drive a car, right? You go over, and I don't know what you guys pay in England, but over here in Texas right now, it's some number like $4 a gallon for gas. If I went down the street and somebody said, you know what? Here we are at the Shackleton Energy Company. You can buy gasoline here for $1 a gallon. So if I sold you gasoline for $1 a gallon, would you go, you know, just out of principle and inertia to the station that sold it to you for $4? Would you say, wow, I think I'm going to put a bigger tank in my car and go get more of that $1 a gallon gas so I can go farther, right? Which one are you going to do? You tell me.
And are you in space in the first place? I mean, are you saying that effectively bringing the price down opens up space travel to far more enterprise than would have been possible before?
It makes things possible you cannot even conceive right now. Let me give you a very good example, okay? Right now, we have hundreds, if not thousands, of geosynchronous telecommunication satellites up there at geosynchronous orbit, 22,000 miles out. When those things have anything go wrong with them, their history, okay? We're talking about $500 million satellites. If a circuit breaker blows, that's it. They've lost that asset. Now, they try to design those as best they can by putting in redundancies, backup systems, and all that. But if a critical component goes, they've lost that $500 million resource. Imagine if you had a fleet of small vehicles sitting in Earth orbit, for lack of a better term here, let's call them orbital transfer vehicles. This has been a name that's been around a while in the industry. The concept has, that is, but it's never been realized. Why? Because of the cost of bringing fuel up from Earth to refuel these things, right? But now, if suddenly gas is 1/14th the cost of bringing it up from Earth, orbital transfer vehicles become enormously profitable. People in the telecommunications industry will pay you to fly one of those devices out to their satellite, send a guy out, bring it into the vehicle, fix it, and put it out there and make it operational for another 5 years. Now they have another $5 billion asset on orbit that's working for another 5 years. That's profit. Utter profit.
And I can see the logic of that. But let's step back for a moment. You talked about the consumables and selling them first to governments and their space mm-hmm. agencies, then to private enterprise.
Sure.
But are these resources yours to sell? I mean, who owns the moon and who owns the rights to its resources?
Nobody owns the moon. That's pretty clear from the Outer Space Treaty. Basically, the terms that are applicable is that you be civilized, there's no land grab, and that any of the resources that come off have to be made available to all people on Earth. Okay, well, all people on Earth really means anybody who's going to come to space who might want them. So that's the plan. We're going to sell to whoever is up there in orbit who will buy them, whether it's the Chinese, the Russians, the Indians, the European Space Agency, or anybody else, whether it's Bob Bigelow with his space hotels or whether it's Richard Branson, you know, bringing up the next round in Spaceship 3 or 4, which will finally get to orbit. Those will be the customers. There will be no nationalism involved, and that is in compliance with the Outer Space Treaty.
Wow. Well, just a reminder to listeners that they are listening to the interview in the BBC World Service with me, Carrie Gracie, and my guest, explorer and engineer Bill Stone. Now, Bill, we'll set aside the questions, and there will be many from the scientists and the engineers and all of them about whether this project is realizable. We've dealt with that whole segment enough, but there is another big issue we do need to look at, and that is, are you the right person to put in charge? So tell us what experience, what skills you bring, what makes a caver the right man for the moon?
First of all, let's dispense with the title caver or cave explorer, okay? It just so happens that over the course of my life, I have pursued exploration here on Earth. And the last frontier, the last true terrestrial frontier, just happens to be going down underground. And when I say that, I mean that in all sincerity. It's not a game. We have places we know right now. In fact, I'm leading an expedition to a place called J2 in southern Mexico. If we are successful over the course of 3.5 months, we may reach a point over 2,000 meters down and possibly 20 to 30 kilometers in from the nearest daylight. So you have to start thinking, when you do these things, what are your logistics? How do you plan for dealing with emergencies and things like that? So this puts you in the mindset of not only working in total darkness, but also working with small teams for long periods of time. We train just like NASA astronauts train, and then we go off and we do these. You say, well, where have I come from? Well, it's a long story going all the way back to when I was in high school. And, you know, I watched John Glenn go into orbit. I watched the Apollo astronauts land on the moon as a teenager. And my assumption was that that's where I was going to go because that's where the governments were going to go. They were going to open up space. And by the time I got through college, you know, and got my PhD, you know, it was going to be open. It was just going to be go apply for the job and go work for the government on the moon. Well, that never happened for a whole lot of reasons. Historically, the whole Apollo project, while enormously successful, was really a political one in nature. And it had no continuity leading forward because once they had demonstrated technological superiority at that time over the Russians, they had achieved their objective that John Kennedy set forth. And at that point, congressional backing started to reduce. So we were left with this hanging hope, if you will, for moving forward. But at the same time, we continued for the course of now 36 years the conduct of expeditionary exploration. And every time we have done these things, it has been pushing the limits.
So hence, this is the background that is going to toughen and train those who need to go to the South Pole of the Moon for perhaps 1 or 2 years to be in temperatures of minus 200 degrees centigrade, possibly without even the return fuel, to get themselves home.
I think it's an excellent first place to look because these people have the right attitude. They have the technological discipline, but more importantly, most importantly, they have the psychology that allows them to work efficiently and safely in very remote, dangerous environments for long periods of time in the dark. There just isn't any other program on Earth that puts all of that together.
And I know, Bill, that you used the recruitment ad that Shackleton put up before the mission to the South Pole a century ago. Men wanted: hazardous journey, small wage, bitter cold, long months of complete darkness, constant danger, safe return doubtful, honor and recognition in case of success. I mean, you use that and it's interesting because it almost sounds as if you see yourself as in that long line of explorers from the Spanish at the turn of the 15th century through to Captain James Cook and the polar explorers and now the moon, the new frontier. I mean, would that be a fair analogy that you see yourself in this long tradition?
That would probably be a dangerously egotistical comment to make. What I would state is that I am a student of exploration history. So all of those missions that you mentioned there, I have read in quite detail, particularly some of the earlier ones. When you look back to like Vasco da Gama, Magellan, Cook, all those people, there was a totally different mindset on those expeditions than any of the work that has been done in space. Probably most importantly is the reason that they were sent in the first place. There were generally two reasons. One was the establishment of national hegemony in distant lands, but more importantly was the production of profit by the bringing back of valuable substances. What most people don't realize, unless you go back and actually study these expeditions, is that they were funded by patrons who wanted to see a positive return on investment. They weren't particularly concerned about the risk. As Shackleton so elegantly put it, you know, honor and recognition in case of success. But on the same token, you know, the other one is safe return doubtful. Well, they really meant that back 500 years ago. When Magellan's crew finally returned, they started off with 5 ships. Only one, the smallest one, returned with a small complement of the original complement of that team. And yet that one ship returning back brought enough material to more than double the investment. Those people thought that was a very wise investment and they went off and did more, which then opened the frontier. Okay. Today, would a government do that? Hell no. It's too much risk to their political support base. They can't do it.
You would take those risks. I mean, you yourself, I know in your career, have seen 16 of your friends and colleagues die on expeditions. I think you've recovered 7 bodies yourself, perhaps the most notorious episode. The drowning of one colleague in a Mexican cave in 1994. As team leader, you've obviously decided to take those risks, but do you feel a sense of personal responsibility?
Of course you do. Of course you do. I mean, we're human, right? But you have to say, and we do this up front with everybody on every expedition. We have to say, look, we are here. We have a mission. The intent is to accomplish the mission within the realm of achievable safety. Nobody says when we go in there that we are not assuming dangerous risk. This is where things depart radically from what is happening in the government-controlled space programs right now. When we talk about working on the moon, okay, there is no one looking over our shoulder out there every second of the way. When you look at the space station, for example, those guys are scripted every second of every waking day by the people who are the controllers on the ground. If something goes wrong, within the space of about 2 hours, those people can be on the ground. That's not the case on the moon. When we're up there, we are autonomous individuals responsible for our own lives. If we make a single human error, you're dead. And that has a lot in common with what we see on expeditionary work. Is that a reason to back away from the frontier? No. You have to pragmatically say, we have to be disciplined as much as we can, but we have to recognize that on the true frontier, people may die. If you're afraid of that, Don't leave your office.
And yet, going back to the question of whether you're the right person to lead your moon mission, as opposed to the right person to lead the project, whether you're the right person to lead the expedition, do you think you've learned from experience? Because I know there were criticisms of you earlier in your career that you were obsessive, that you pushed your teams to destruction, that you were given to rages.
Oh, I don't know about rages. I think that's probably an exaggeration. Do I push a team? Of course. Do I push them dangerously? No. That's a personal reflection of where you are. And part of the thing is, if you're on a team with projects that we do, you have to self-regulate, because nobody can be looking over your shoulder 100% of the time. If you aren't able to self-regulate, or if you are not able to self-assess that you are uncomfortable with the current situation, then it is your responsibility to bail out, whether that means bailing out of the particular mission you're on right now or bailing out of the project in general. I think the people that will be attracted to this project are free thinkers who understand the historical significance of this. We have constructed it as a business, but there is no question that the people that this project will attract initially will be these expeditionary people.
Yeah, but I'm not talking about them right now. I'm talking about you, Bill Stone. I mean, have you had to get rid of people in your life to give yourself the freedom to calculate these risks for yourself rather than let anyone else?
I think the term getting rid of is rather harsh. One establishes priorities. You are who you are. Okay, and it has taken me a good while to realize that, but as of perhaps 15 years ago, I said, you know what? Exploration and expeditions are my life. This is where I live. What I do in between time to make money and survive is engineering and science and technology development, and I attempt to do that as best as I possibly can professionally.
And then just working out whether, you know, for an investor, is this the right man to lead the expedition? 7 years from now, we're talking about being the first practicable moment when this mining could begin on the moon. Now, you'll be almost 60 then. Is it possible, even with your formidable strength and stamina, you're just too old at that point?
Oh, that's a real red herring, isn't it? I think that question was definitively put to an end about 10 years ago when they launched John Glenn on the shuttle at the age of 77. That was probably the most important thing that NASA did with the entire space shuttle program, was launching John, demonstrating, in fact, that in space, age is irrelevant. It is the skill set and whether you are physically fit and mentally capable. At my age, I work on expeditions where the demographics largely put the mean age somewhere between 25 and 35. If you're going to work with those people and they are world-class Olympic athletes, you have to stay in shape. And I have had that requirement placed on me for as long as I've been doing this stuff. So right now, you know, I do have a very stiff training schedule that I do. I stay in shape.
And you sound like a very purposeful, very focused individual. Some of those listening may think, well, the focus, though, is the objective to make history rather than to make money for a bunch of investors. What would you say to those skeptics?
I would say, first of all, you got it wrong. Okay, that would be highly egotistical to go into this with the purpose of making history. It is an ancillary product if we're successful. Okay, but that is not the driving thing. That's an excellent question you ask, and I'll tell you why. One of the classic mistakes that people make that cost them their lives in expeditionary work is focusing themselves on something that would be a record, a number, an importance within history. When you do that, you are blocking out all of the signals and senses that tell you don't go any further. I have a lot of friends who crossed that regime because they did that. Okay. The goal here is to open space and make it possible for businesses to survive out there and make money, okay? The ancillary benefit for people like myself is that it is required to have people of our nature, expeditionary people, to make this thing start, okay? That, to me, is the reward, the privilege of being on the frontier. That is why I am doing this.
So when they write the history, and even if it is of ancillary benefit, as far as you're concerned, and when they add the 21st century chapter to that history of exploration that you yourself say that you read, Will it be that Bill Stone joins Columbus, Magellan, Cook, Shackleton? And if so, what will they say about you?
I sure hope they don't say he screwed up.
Is that your greater fear than dying?
Of course. It's the astronaut's prayer. Yeah, I am not afraid of death, okay? That's a statement of fact. Those who are will not be in the exploration business.
And when you go to the moon and the history of exploration of that mission is written, is it going to say Bill Stone returned a profit to his investors?
I sure hope so. Otherwise, there won't be many to follow it.
Bill, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. We wish you the best of luck. Thanks very much for joining us on the interview.
Thank you much for the privilege of talking.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. The details of them all go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.